Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. President Trump said he does not think North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is trying to deceive anyone by agreeing to work toward removing all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula and vowing to pursue talks that would bring a formal end to the Korean War. Mr. Trump spoke to reporters saying he will make sure any agreements with North Korea works for everyone.
It's certainly something that I hope I can do for the world. This is beyond the United States. This is a world problem. And it's something that I hope I'm able to do for the world.
Kim and South Korean President Moon Jae-in held an inter-Korean summit Friday, the first such meeting in 10 years. In the coming weeks, President Trump will meet with Kim Jong-un. After making his diplomatic debut in Brussels at the NATO foreign ministers' meeting, new Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Saudi Arabia Saturday on the first stop of a swing through the Middle East, also visiting Israel and Jordan. Pompeo is expected to brief U.S. allies on administration policy towards Iran. Pompeo says no decision has been made on whether President Trump will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, adding that negotiations are ongoing. Pompeo said he had discussed the nuclear deal when he was meeting with his NATO counterparts. A suicide bomber attacked a tea restaurant in central Somalia Saturday, killing at least four Somali government soldiers and wounding six others. The attack happened on the northern side of the town, controlled by the Puntland semi-autonomous region. No one claimed immediate responsibility for the attack, but it had the hallmarks of an al-Shabaab attack. For more news, join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong says the Islamic State still poses a very real threat to the ASEAN region.
ISIS continues to propagate its ideology and to foment trouble in Southeast Asia, despite having been defeated militarily in the Middle East.
Lee's comments came during an opening address at the Summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Singapore. Lee also warned the region's embrace of technology also makes it especially vulnerable. In another matter, Lee said the summit agreed to encourage Myanmar and Bangladesh to return refugees to their homes in a safe, secure, and dignified way without undue delay. Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani has slammed the Taliban for pushing ahead with its so-called annual spring offensive despite his most generous offer of peace. The Taliban on Wednesday unleashed its new military campaign that led to scores of coordinated guerrilla-style raids and bombings against Afghan security forces. A Taliban suicide bomber detonated his explosives-laden vehicle in the early morning hours on Saturday near an Afghan army base in southern Helmand province, killing at least six people, wounding many other there. And the Trump administration has abandoned plans to appoint a new ambassador to Australia. Phil Mercer reports many Australians do not trust President Trump and view this as a snub.
The last permanent U.S. ambassador to Canberra was John Berry, who left the post in 2016. The Trump administration had planned to nominate Admiral Harry Harris from the U.S. Pacific Command as the next United States ambassador to Australia. That decision has been reversed, and Admiral Harris, a high-ranking Japanese-American naval officer, will instead become Washington's envoy in South Korea. Former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says President Trump is in danger of taking Australia, a long-standing ally, for granted.
I think the bottom line is the administration's decided that South Korea demonstrably is strategically more important, given what's happening with the inter-Korean summit. And you can understand that reasoning. But for Australia, I think it does indicate, at least from the view of the Trump administration, we are seen as something as a second-rate ally.
Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Britain's Interior Minister Amber Rudd has resisted calls to quit, apologizing for not being aware of the use of migrant removal targets in her department and vowing to implement fair and humane immigration policy. The political controversy surrounding one of Prime Minister Theresa May's closest allies coincides with Britain entering crucial negotiations on a future trade deal with the European Union and amid rising domestic tension over the Brexit policy. For more news, join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us on the interphone. Former Malawian President Joyce Banda returns home Saturday.
President Buhari is not a member of the Nigerian elite. Rather, he's a member of the Nigerian counter-elite.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari plans to meet President Donald Trump at the White House next week.
One of the most, or if not the most powerful person in the country. So the fact that he has stepped down, at least publicly, it is his willingness to step down. It has given into the Angolan society a fresh air.
And former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos steps down as the leader of the ruling MPLA. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former Malawian President Joyce Banda returned home Saturday, ending years of a self-imposed exile. Supporters from an opposition People's Party were at the airport in the commercial capital Blantyre to welcome her home. The former Malawian president was living in the United States, serving as a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Analysts say her return ends speculations that she was afraid of arrest on corruption charges. For reaction about her return to Malawi, I reached Andekuche Chantunya, spokesperson for the former Malawian president.
Dr. Joyce Banda landed at 12 o'clock and she had a small press briefing and there were lots of people. So she then went out and spoke to the people who were outside. There were probably over 5,000 people who had come to welcome her. From there, she started off to her hometown of Zomba District. And on her way to Zomba, people have just joined a convoy. We're probably in the convoy of about 100 cars right now and heading to her house. And right now, we've just gotten to our home house in the village, a house in the village. And there are lots of people who've come to welcome her. People are excited. People see this as a sign of, it seems like they're getting hope again.
What is her next line of action after arriving in the country?
Well, tomorrow, Dr. Joyce Banda will be addressing a political rally here in her home district of Zomba, Malosa. And so she will hear what she has to say about everything that has happened. But yes, that's her next political action, is that she has a political rally here tomorrow.
Is it likely that she will declare her intention of possibly running to represent the opposition party to challenge incumbent President Atta Peter Mutharika in next year's election?
We really don't know about that, but I can assure you that that's a matter for the convention, the People's Party convention, to decide who is going to be the torchbearer. I don't think that she would make such a declaration. That would be for the convention.
There are concerns that the police still have an arrest warrant pending against her. What are her supporters saying about this? Because despite the Anti-Corruption Bureau saying they don't have evidence implicating her in the cash gate, the arrest warrant issued by the police remains.
Well, the police said that they obtained a warrant of arrest, but this is a warrant of arrest that we have no knowledge about. Dr. Joyce Banda is now in the country. If they do have a warrant of arrest, let them come. Let them present it to her. But otherwise, as far as we know, there is no court in this country that has issued any warrant of arrest for Dr. Banda. As far as we know, there is no agency in this country that connects Dr. Joyce Banda to any corruption allegations or any fraud allegations. So as far as we know, there is no one who is after Dr. Joyce Banda for any reason. The police with the warrant of arrest that we have no information about. So until they present that warrant to us, It can only be speculation.
What was her message to the people of Malawi when she held the press conference and followed it up with addressing them upon her arrival?
Her message was just to thank the people for staying with her, for staying with the party, and to literally just tell Malawians that in a few weeks or so, she's going to address a press conference, a press briefing, to discuss issues that are actually happening. But today was not for such in-depth discussion. Today was just to thank people over their support through the years. And it was overwhelming for her that there were so many people than she had actually expected.
Andekuche Chantunya is the spokesperson for the former Malawian president, Joyce Banda. He spoke with me from Zomba, southern Malawi. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is scheduled to depart the country Saturday ahead of his anticipated meeting with President Donald Trump next week. But the president faces a host of challenges back home following his announcement that he will seek re-election in next year's general election. It came after the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Nigeria called on him to resign after accusing him of failing to improve the country's security despite repeated promises to do so. For analysis of the latest development, I reach Kayode Soremakun, a professor of political science at the Federal University Oye Ekiti.
I don't think Nigerians have any expectations from this particular visit. I see it more as a kind of a new momentum as regards Abuja-Washington relations, which I must confess really have nothing to do with Nigerian people. It's a normal diplomatic intercourse. That's the way they look at it.
The meeting comes at a time when President Buhari has made it known that he seeks re-election. He wants the mandate of Nigerians for yet another 4 years. However, he also faces backlash and accusations at home. How are Nigerians taking his decision or his announcement that he seeks re-election?
Let me put it this way. Let's try to separate what I can call the media image from the reality. And this is very, very important. The point to note here is that President Buhari is not a member of the Nigerian elite. Rather, is a member of the Nigerian counter-elite. And to that extent, the backlash you are seeing is coming from the decadent Nigerian elite who are of the view that it is no longer business as usual in Nigeria. This might be an unusual view, but that is what is happening. In Nigeria at the moment, it is no longer easy to make easy money. All the leakages continue to be plugged. All the emergency millionaires and billionaires, they're on the run. And for the first time, we have a man in public life who is saying no to corruption. And that explains why he's being so heavily criticized. Because I'll tell you this, almost every member of the Nigerian elite, political, social, economic, they are on the take. This particular man stands out. And to that extent, that explains the backlash that you can mostly see in the media. Because even the Nigerian media is also culpable. And that explains the more or less what you can call organized hostility to this man. Take a look at Nigeria from independence till date. Has any other leader staked out like this in the area of corruption? No. And that is why he has made so many enemies.
The Christian Association of Nigeria, at a news conference on Friday, accused President Buhari's administration of bringing back the dark age. Do you think that criticism is justified?
That particular criticism, in my own opinion, is not justified. We are looking at a country that is in the grip of anomie. Anomie spawned by various discontented groups. Anomie spawned by members of the elite who have lost out in the current arrangement. And that is why many of them are creating these problems. If you remember earlier on, when Buhari assumed power, he was able to quell the insurgency in the northeast. all of a sudden, we have this kind of upsurge on the part of so-called henchmen. So who is really doing it?
The Catholic Bishops' Conference of Nigeria on Friday called on the president also to resign. Some of his supporters are saying it was uncalled for. Some are saying that Christians appear to try to turn other Christian supporters against him being a Fulani Muslim. What is your take?
Where was this country before this man got into power? The country was on the verge of moral bankruptcy. The country was on the verge of economic collapse. The country was in the grips of predators, of robbers, of looters. And to that extent, we should be very, very wary. We should be aware of where we are coming from. Most people do not want to give credit to President Buhari. But let me tell you this. Whatever anybody says, he's still the best material available for this country at this point in time. Is it not curious that as he's been lampooned, as he's been harassed, nobody has come forth and said, this is the alternative to him. And we're still waiting to see who will be the alternative to him. For instance, a man like President Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president, went to town against him. Ask yourself, what was Obasanjo's own record in the area of governance, in the area of corruption, in the area of subverting the constitution as regards his third-term attempt? So let us put this in perspective. A call for him to resign, I believe, is impulsive, is peremptory, and does not bode well for this country.
Kayode Soremakun is a professor of political science at the Federal University Oye Ekiti. Spoke with me from Ekiti, Southwest Nigeria. Former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos says he will step down as the leader of the ruling Angolan People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA. The move allows the ruling party to choose a new leader in September. Local media reports say the current president, João Lourenço, will take over from dos Santos as the new party leader later this year. For the latest development, I reached Frio Julio Candiero from the Mosaico Center, an NGO in the Angolan capital, Luanda.
He has announced that he will retire from the active political life in 2018. So this is just the president trying to be faithful to what he promised to the Angolan people. And there's been a lot of talking about bicephalies, about the two centers of power within the party, meaning himself as the president and his vice president, who is the president of the republic. So this moment may leave us the opportunity to see if this idea that there were two opposing forces within the party is true or not.
Talking about the fight against corruption, Isabel dos Santos, who is Africa's richest woman, recently said on a Twitter feed that her family is being witch-hunted by the current administration. Is this the reality on the ground?
There is no way we can talk about fighting corruption without having people on board, you see? So it's true that they are on the spotlight, but it's not because of whom they are. It's because their involvement in the issues of, at least their alleged involvement in the issues of corruption. So anyone who was previously in any position of power is a possible candidate to be heard on issues of corruption. So I don't think it's something against the Dos Santos family. There's no doubt that the Dos Santos family, a family that ruled the country for such a long time, are in a way related to these things, and they will be called necessarily because they are the ones who know the issues of the country. But we do not perceive the fight against corruption as being a persecution against the Dos Santos family or any family as such.
With the stepping down of former President Dos Santos as the head of the ruling party, does that give the current president, who appears to be very popular in Angola, the free hand to put the country in a direction that most Angolans want?
Well, it remains to be seen, because we don't know what are the support that he has got within the bureau, the secretariat of the bureau of the party. You know, because the president, Dos Santos, may step down, but people who support him or people who are against the current president may be a strong wing within the party and not allow him to do the moves he wants to do. So it's true that President Dos Santos is an exceptionally powerful person who has a lot of followers. But it's not the fact that he has stepped down that MPLA necessarily is willing to move to other direction. It remains to be seen if within the party or all the members of the bureau are comfortable enough with some positions that the current president is taking, if they are going to be behind him or not and support his idea or not. This will remain to be seen, because currently some people seem to be assuming that they are more for João Lourenço than for Dos Santos.
In a lot of African countries where such scenarios have happened, where you have the former president leading the party with a different presidential candidate or a different president, there appears to always be two centers of power with both leaders pulling the country in two different directions, sometimes creating confusion, suspicion, and anger on both sides. Didn't the Angolan ruling MPLA see this happening or learn from other countries in Africa?
I think we have to give some credit to President Dos Santos for stepping down. We don't know all the reasons, but it has been a fresh head for the Angolan politics to see a man who could have continued stepping down. I don't know if he was forced, if he has health reasons. Whatever reasons it might be, at least externally, he had the opportunity to continue, because he was one of the most, or if not the most powerful person in the country. So the fact that he has stepped down, at least publicly, it is his willingness to step down. It has given into the Angolan society a fresh air.
Frio Julio Candiero is from the Mosaic Center, an Angolan NGO. He spoke with me from Luanda. The Democratic Republic of Congo's main opposition leader, Felix Tshisekedi, has rejected reports that President Joseph Kabila will soon appoint him as the next prime minister. His remark came after suggestions that he would strike a deal with the president. Local media reports say there are plans by the administration to appoint the opposition leader as the next prime minister. Tshisekedi denies the reports as false. For more, I reach Ibrahim Luakabwanga, National Secretary in charge of communication for the opposition party Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS, and spokesperson for Felix Tshisekedi.
This rumor has been spread out here in Kinshasa, but also reported by international newspaper. What I can tell you is on Tuesday, April 24th, the new president of UDPS, Felix Tshisekedi, says no, he's not asking to be the next prime minister or demanding to be appointed, because actually the government, which is led by Mr. Tshibala, has signed an agreement with the family and the party concerning the burial of our late president, Dr. Tshisekedi. So a rumor was spread out saying that in exchange, Felix was going to accept the nomination to charge prime minister. He publicly denied to do so. So that question is actually over. He says that he's aiming to be the next president of the DRC through the election that should be taking place in December 23rd, 2018.
Talking about the election, some opposition supporters are criticizing the president of wanting to use that election as a referendum to change the constitution to seek additional terms in office. Officials of the government have flatly refused that. How do you respond to that?
I will respond saying, since I'm also in the opposition, that our partners, they're right. We've been fighting since 2016, 2015 for the election to take place in the DRC. Remember, we had a long meeting that was called the dialogue at the SANCO. During almost 4 months, we discussed about the outcome of election that should have taken place before the end of President Kabila's second term on December 19th, 2016. We gave him an extension until December 2017, expecting him to hold elections, what he failed to do. And now we keep on saying he's a move, knowing that he doesn't want elections to take place in the DRC. That's why there's been, you know, sending rumors out there asking the UDPS through Felix Tshisekedi to agree, to accept the to be the prime minister that is going to be for them. Easy to say, we don't have what it takes to organize election 2018. Let's go maybe for 2019 or 2020. We're asking the international community, such as the Congolese, to open their eyes and to be focused. And we won't let this happen in the DRC because too much is too much.
Supporters of the president are saying that Mr. Enanga's choosing December 23rd as the election date is an indication of the commitment of the president not to seek additional term in office. Why do you disagree?
We just disagree because it's simple. President Kabila just can't go out there, talk to the press, talk to the nation, saying that I won't seek a third term. This is constitutional. We, all of us, ask questions why he doesn't want to do so. Remember, a few months ago, the SANCO, the Catholic Church, asked him to go publicly and to say that he's not going to search for a third term. The SADC also asked him, you know, to do so. Actually, the main issue we do have is the credibility of President Kabila or his commitment to follow and to do the right thing according to our constitution. But signs that we are seeing are not, you know, giving us, you know, peace or, you know, give us confidence that President Kabila is not going to step out of power.
What do you make of the new Botswana president's recent statement asking President Kabila not to seek additional terms in office?
What I will say is I agree with the president of Botswana, and I ask for the community, the international community, to do so, because Congo is one of the largest, the second largest country in Africa. And I think this country has nine neighbors. If it's well managed, it should be one of the country that's going to lead Africa into a real development. So we cannot, you know, work in such a way that we gain 1 or 2 years of peace, and after that, somebody, because he doesn't want to leave the power, wants to lead all the country, almost 80 million of people, into trouble. Remember, Congo is not stable since now, and Congo needs to be well managed. And we, as UDPS, we have, with all our friends in the opposition, what it takes to bring this country to the next level. And we hope that President Kabila will understand exactly what the president of Botswana told him, and he's going to follow it just for the sake of our Congolese people.
Abraham Luaka Bwanga is the national secretary in charge of communication for DRC's opposition, UDPS, and spokesperson for Felix Tshisekedi. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Nigerian Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the government is committed to winning the fight against extremist militant group Boko Haram. The administration has come under criticisms after saying the militant group has been technically defeated. The critics say the recent surge in violence carried out by Boko Haram militants are clear indications that the Buhari administration has failed, an accusation the government rejects. Information Minister Mohammed paid a visit to the VOA studios this week. I sat down with him and began by asking what the administration plans are to combat terrorism and particularly Boko Haram.
My government is determined to completely dismantle the Boko Haram and any terrorist insurgency in Nigeria. And our records speak very loudly as to our commitment to this endeavor. When we say that Boko Haram has been technically defeated or they have been massively decimated, you must take our statement from where we started and where we are today. Before 2015, Boko Haram was in complete control of over 24 local governments in the northeastern part of Nigeria. Precisely in Borno State alone, 20 out of 27 local governments were under the effective control of Boko Haram. Another 5, thereabout, in Yobe and Adamawa states. Nightlife has returned to Maiduguri. Roads have been opened. Schools have been reopened. And if you go to Maiduguri today, unless you are told, you will not even know that there's any insurgency. Now, the Abuja, the capital territory, was attacked about 4 times before 2015. Once the United Nations headquarters, unfortunately, was bombed, many lives were lost. The Inspector General of Police, headquarters also, ditto with the this day, newspaper headquarters, and twice, the Yayam, motor park. But since 2015, there has been no single incident of any attack, in the capital. Now, but that does not mean that you're not going to have some cowardly, suicide, attacks or what happened in Dapchi.
Let's talk about the Nigerian economy. How is it today? And can the typical Nigerian be confident in trying to find a job to fend for his family or her family?
Well, you see, all the indices today point to an economy that is rapidly growing. We inherited an economy that was headed for recession. Because if you look at the GDP of the country in 2011, it's about 5.23, percent. By 2015, it had gone down to about 2.35. So it was a matter of time for it to hit recession, especially given the price of crude oil that was going down. Now, but not only were we able within two quarters to come out of recession, but we have maintained a steady growth since we came out of recession in 2017. And all the indices point to an economy that is on the road to recovery. Our foreign reserve has gone from $23 billion to $47 billion. We've been adjudged one of the best reforming economies by the World Bank. We made 24 steps up in the ease of doing business. We went out of recession not because the price of oil went down, but because we were able to diversify. Actually, it was agriculture, mining, and other services that took us out of a recession. And when you look at the figures today, whether you're talking about foreign reserve or foreign capital inflow, which peaked at about $12.8 billion in the fourth quarter of 2017, or you are looking at indices such as inflation, which has gone down consistently for 11 months, or you're looking at indices such as employment. We as a government, one first move, we employed about 200,000 unemployed graduates in 2016, and another 200,000 are waiting to be employed. And then you look at what we've done in the social programs. Today, we feed 7.5 million pupils every day, and that has created over 60,000 jobs for cooks in 24 states. Our JIP has touched 300,000, cooperatives, while our conditional cash transfer, it's been enjoyed by about 250,000, most vulnerable families in Nigeria.
Well, I'm not cutting you short, but some of the critics say a lot of figures are bandied around by the government. However, that is not a true reflection of what is on the ground. How do you respond to that?
You see, we challenge them to say, actually, we have not employed 200,000 unemployed youths. We challenge them to say that we are not feeding 7.5 million pupils in 24 states of the Federation. We challenge them to say that our foreign reserve is not actually gone to 47 billion. We challenge them to say that inflation has not gone down from 18% to 13%. These are facts that you cannot, you can't manufacture, because other people, other organizations in the world also know about it and about them. So, talk is cheap, talk is very cheap, but these are the facts today. Our facts, nobody, can challenge them, because they are the facts. They are intimidated by these facts, because, when the price of crude was at an all-high of $120, they were not able to do anything. And when the price of oil, crashed, because sometimes in 2016, we sold oil for as little as $28 a barrel. Yet we have been able to achieve, this little. And look at what we've done in the area of infrastructure. We've been able to complete 715 kilometers of road, and we have been able to rehabilitate 600 kilometers of road. In power, we inherited 2,690 megawatts of power. Today, we are generating 7,001 megawatts of power. We used to transmit under 4,000 megawatts. We are transmitting over 5,000 megawatts today. So, these are verifiable figures for anybody, whether local or international, bodies to find out.
Let's look at the issue of herders. Some people are saying these Fulani herdsmen have been creating security concerns. They particularly accuse the president of not doing enough or not saying anything about what they called the catastrophe these people have been creating in the country. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Elections are coming, and today everything has been politicized. So Mr. President is doing everything possible to put an end to this farmers herders clash. But we must understand really the genesis of this farmers herders clash. It's neither religious, ethnic, nor ethnic. It's more environmental, social, and economic. I'll just give two or three examples. Now, in 1963, the Lake Chad had a surface area of about 25,000 square kilometers, from which seven African countries, such as Central African Republic, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Co., were sustaining their people. Over 35 million lives from those seven countries depended on farming, fishing, irrigation from Lake Chad. Now that Lake Chad has lost 90% of its surface water, those same people have to move south to look for, pasture, to look for food, to look for water. Or look at the population of Nigeria itself. 1963, we were just under 52 million. Today, we are about 190 million, which means that the same space, same land, same water, same grass available for 52 million people are now being shared by 190 million people. So you can imagine there could be pressure. And this is the real truth about it. It's environmental, it's social, it's economic. But what the government is doing is that government has agreed and is encouraging farmers to, you know, adopt higher, you know, I mean, better technology for higher yield because the land is no longer there. And encouraging also, you know, herders to adopt ranching as the ultimate solution. But you see, it takes time to get there. Anybody that tries to introduce religion or ethnicity, I think, is just being mischievous.
Let's look at the president's recent announcement of seeking re-election next year in 2019. How confident are you that he's going to win? And there, is there a possibility that he could have an internal challenge to represent the APC in next year's election?
Well, that's why we're having a convention and we're having primaries, and anybody is free to contest against, you know, against Mr. President if he feels that he has numbers, you know, among the party faithfuls. But as to the president contesting, I think he's contesting, one, because he believes that he has delivered. And I believe, too, that he delivered on his electoral, you know, electoral promises. He promised Nigeria that he was going to fight corruption, was going to fight insecurity, and was going to revamp the economy, and has delivered on all the three promises.
Well, his critics deny that he has been able to do that because they said lofty promises he made during the election period are not what they are seeing today.
That's why they are called critics. If they are his friends, they will not be called critics. But on a more serious note, I've just told you here that we have facts and figures to show that we have delivered on all our promises. And I said with insecurity. I give the example of how many local governments in northeastern states of the country were under the effective occupation of Boko Haram. When I say effective occupation, I'm saying when they were in control, they had their own government, they had their own, they deposed emirs, appointed emirs, they collected taxes, they ran schools. As a matter of fact, when I entered Burma on the 5th of December, 2015, I thought I was in Saudi Arabia or Algeria because all the signboards, all the road signs were in Arabic. That was how effective the Boko Haram was then. But today, they have scampered. Even the Sambisa Forest is today has been leveled, you know, to the ground by the military. So let anybody come and challenge us that we have not done enough on security. Now, I also give examples of how people in Abuja could not sleep with their two eyes closed. And all the incidents of, you know, bomb attacks in Abuja, none has occurred since, you know, 2015. So, I mean, on security, I don't think anybody can honestly argue that the government has not done enough.
What about the president's health? Because we all remember the president sought medical attention in the UK or abroad. Some people are saying the president still doesn't look good and he might not be medically fit to run the affairs of Nigeria, and that is why they don't want him to seek re-election.
I saw the president when he was ill, before he traveled. I saw him in London when he was ill, was recovering. He's been back since August, has been presiding over council meetings, has been attending to his duties, and I'm here to see a person who has been fitter since he came back, and every day improves. I think the fear of those who don't want the president to run is not because they are genuinely concerned about his health or the health of the country. I think it's because they have this morbid fear that a re-election of Mr. President would finally unveil and reveal the massive corruption that took place under their watch.
You came up with a list of looters that you said embezzled public funds, committing, you know, financial malfeasance here and there. How credible is the list, and why this time? Some people are saying this is just a nice ploy to shield the government from criticisms.
I think that's not correct. You see, remember in 2016, I actually issued a statement saying that between 2006 and 2013, that just 55 people in Nigeria embezzled about $6 billion, if you remember. Now, SERAP, which is an NGO, recently confirmed that. Now, remember, we said so too then in 2016, but that if only one-third of that money was returned to the treasury, that it would build about 400 kilometers of double expressway, about 22,000 housing units. It would feed, it would educate, I think we said about 20,000 children from primary school to university level. This, and we did not manufacture these facts. And fortunately, almost 2 years later, CELAP confirmed this kind of mass looting. Now, two, you remember that it was actually, we were challenged by the PDP. The vice president made a statement in which he said, in one single day, the PDP government under President Jonathan shelled $289 million for election. But the records are there, those who took them. And don't forget that in 2013, the then president of Central Bank raised an alarm about a discrepancy of $20 billion between oil sales and oil receipts. Now, if that $20 billion was accounted for today, we'll be able to complete the Lagos-Kano Railroad, modern gauge road. We'll be able to complete the Niger East-West Road, the second Niger Bridge, not to talk about, all within that $20 billion US that we cannot account for today. And when we came in also, we actually really revealed to the world that the Atlantic Energy cannot account for $3 billion. Recently, we went for a second tranche of Eurobond for exactly $3 billion. So when we talk about massive looting, we're not cooking the figures. We're not saying we are not talking about election, because I raised this issue first time in 2016, if you remember. So what? And if we had not been challenged, we'd been quite, I don't know what I can use. We are not in a hurry to release this latest news until we were challenged. Now we are challenged. They're now running to court for injunctions. So if anybody thinks it's for election purposes, not at all.
Lai Mohammed is the Nigerian Information Minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
To see my lawyer, this been a total cheat. You must see my lawyer. One virgin, one two virgin, one 3 virgin. Shayna, you be born 4 virgin. Yeah, you be back on a virgin, and a virgin, back on a virgin, and a virgin, back on a virgin. Shayna, you be born 4 virgin. Yeah, Almanta could do my beat, and she would not fit come by your man. Almanta mi kebi tada shi ala rai rai ala ki eh oh yalman simle ma sona blamle mangura ngo sona bashile no name ngo sona bafuxile ashile kura tell why you lie me say you be brand new girl even now no say you dey lie me girl no no I know one pink and I mean to and yes I do you and I mean to now I love you why you brown me I love you why you dey brown me you know say I love you why you Why be say I marry you beautiful? This day and you are ugly. Why be say I marry you beautiful? This day and you are ugly. This been a total cheat. You must see my lawyer. This been a total cheat. You must see my lawyer. One virgin, one 2 virgin, one 2 virgin, one 3 virgin. Shayna, you be born 4 virgin. Yeah, you be back on a virgin.
Virgin, Tibujara, me na wa ye mi se mi si se me ne wara. Si si a wa bo me kafa ni se mi ni dama. Odi e wo, mu fa me nkwake na fama. Make up a ma wedi ma da me princess. So what's around the bag, yo sempa. Se mo se me bua, the Lord is my witness. E ma bi ni suba e ni anu mo ma ye nka ma bre.
I don't know you be born 1 virgin.
What else?
1 virgin, 1 2 virgin.
1 2 virgin,
1 3 virgin. Shayna, you be born 4 virgin. Yeah. You be back on a virgin. Can a virgin, back on a virgin. Virgin, what kind of virgin? She never give me no for virgin, yeah.
Size on the beat. know you want this. Baby girl, you're from Angola, sister from South Africa. Pretty girl, I wanna hold ya. Talk to my ladies in Nigeria. African bad girl, baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are, the way you are.
Feeling your dancing, huh? Stars on the beat.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when you live next to the cemetery, you cannot weep for everyone. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the worst in the world. 13 million people in the DRC are in need of humanitarian assistance. At least 4.5 million have been displaced. More than 7 million face severe food insecurity, and 2 million children are at risk of starvation. Although the country is rich in natural resources, the causes for the catastrophic humanitarian situation are manifold, stemming from persistent insecurity driven by the activities of armed groups and ethnic tensions in several regions. The political impasse resulting from delayed elections has also undermined state authority and risks increased violence and unrest. While elections alone will not solve the DRC's many challenges, they are critical to ensuring a democratic and peaceful transition, averting violence, and strengthening democratization, stability, and economic development. International donors recently convened in Geneva for a United Nations conference aimed at helping to relieve the suffering of the Congolese people. The response was encouraging, with pledges offered of $528 million. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock said he was pleased with the progress made toward the $1.7 billion funding goal for the DRC. And I'm even more pleased, he said, that there are additional pledges that governments are working on. The United States is providing nearly $67 million in additional humanitarian assistance to provide food, shelter, health care, and other urgent aid for vulnerable Congolese and refugees. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert noted that the United States is the largest single donor supporting this humanitarian response. With the new announcement, she said, we are providing nearly $277 million since fiscal year 2017 in critical assistance to the people in need in the DRC and for Congolese refugees in the region. Ms. Nauert urged more donors to provide resources to help those suffering in the DRC, and she called on the government there to take steps to address the underlying causes of insecurity that have given rise to the displacement and conflict that have fueled the humanitarian crises. She welcomed the pledges from the other donors at the Geneva conference, which, at $500 million, was on par with the entire amount raised in 2017. 8 countries more than doubled their support, she noted, and major pledges came in from the United States, the EU, the United Kingdom, Belgium, Sweden, and Canada. So we thank those countries for their assistance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.